Okay, so good morning again, and welcome to this session. We call it Health Happens Here, Building Community Power and Systems Change for Social and Health Equity in California. And we're absolutely delighted that you're here. I'm Dr. Tony Eitan, and I'm one of the Senior Vice Presidents at the California Endowment. And I recognize probably a third of the people in the room, and so I'm glad the room is appropriately spiked with ringers. So you guys know all the applause lines and the cheer sequences? Good. So what we're trying to do today, and hopefully in as interactive a fashion as possible, is to give you kind of an overview of building healthy communities, which is our, what we think could serve as a promising model for a 21st century public health practice. And it's a practice that's designed to get at the difficult question of entrenched disparities throughout communities that we have essentially recognized represent inequities. So the goal here is to really focus on the practice, not so much the problem. And we have three exceptional speakers here today that are all partners. In fact, Daniel is my colleague within the endowment, and you'll hear from him at the end. But two community partners who are key leaders in their respective fields and essential partners in the work that we're doing, and I'll introduce them in a minute. I want to also give the regrets of our CEO, Bob Ross, who was supposed to be here today. However, he serves on the California Health Exchange Board, which is the essentially the mechanism for implementing the Affordable Care Act here in California, and they're meeting today. And we take that role very seriously. We're delighted that there's a public health presence on that exchange board, and we believe that we can serve as a conduit for some of the very good public health ideas into that exchange board, which, by the way, is an opportunity and an I'm trying to encourage you to get the public health voice in on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, because to date, public health has been nearly absent from that conversation. And we have opportunities and the responsibility to essentially make sure that the implementation of the Affordable Care Act serves the broad needs of the public health community in California, and who knows those needs better than those of us who practice in public health in California. So again, thank you for being here, and let's get started. Okay, so I'd like to start these things with my conclusions, and part of our work has forced us to recognize that health is political. And that's a small p, political, meaning that it involves this definition of politics, which is the struggle over the allocation of scarce and precious social goods. And our recognition of health as political is something that actually makes some people very uncomfortable. And I think that, that's actually quite good, because we need to actually disrupt people's thinking to be able to make changes in the entrenched inequities that we see presenting in our health system and throughout our public health practice. So when we say scarce and precious social goods, we're talking about things, not radical things, we're talking about things like a grocery store or a park or some trees that can create treescape along a walkway. The key part of this definition is that it's a struggle, and it's not for the faint of heart. So what we're describing is a kind of public health practice that's a little bit more muscular than your grandmother's public health practice. It's a public health practice that actually challenges the status quo. So we know health doesn't equal health care, and we know that where you live matters, and we know that it matters a lot. And you'll see, and you'll hear from Daniel, but you'll see kind of festooned throughout this whole conference our billboards and our messaging around the disparities that we see at the zip code level and at the neighborhood level. And I like to say, if you give me your address, I'll tell you how long you're going to live. I'm serious. We translated that to, does your zip code matter more than your genetic code? Another conclusion in this work is that there are no silver bullets. And the question I get asked most often is, what's the one thing? This is a reporter question. They must train them in journalism school to ask this question. What's the one thing that I need to know about this issue? And I started saying, the one thing you need to know is that you can no longer ask that question. You have to understand that there are multiple levers of influence on essentially people's opportunities. And we have to be operating at all of those levers simultaneously if we intend to be effective. Thank you for the applause for that. Okay, so here's a map of California. For those of you who are not from California, we're in San Francisco. This is the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Alameda, that's San Francisco, and this is Alameda County, where I used to be the director and health officer, and many of my former colleagues are in the audience, and I appreciate their presence here, and I also appreciate the great work that led to a deeper understanding of how to approach some of these entrenched inequities. So Alameda County is shaped like a boot. I'm just showing it to you because I'm going to show you a couple maps in a second. And the foot part of the boot is sort of Berkeley and Oakland and the older part of the county. And then there's a freeway that goes down to the heel and a freeway that goes up the laces that lead to 70s and 80s era suburbs, respectively. This is a death certificate, which is a fabulous source of data. It's, in fact, when we were trying to understand, we used to publish a report at Alameda County that looked at essentially 20 indicators. And of those 20 indicators, year after year, we would see 16 of the 20 showed profound disparities amongst African Americans. And at some point, I said, I just got tired of publishing the same report. So we wanted to understand what was driving those disparities. What could explain the correlation between those health disparities and the educational disparities and the housing disparities and all of the disparities in the social determinants of health that we were sort of ignoring by just publishing this decontextualized data on health disparities. So we went to death certificates and we wanted to study them. And on a death certificate, you can find out how old somebody was when they died, where they lived, their race, ethnicity to some extent, and their address. And you can use that data to essentially study the patterns of death and the distribution of death in a community. And so that's what we did. And so we took the boot and described it according to its census tracts. There are about 150 of them. And then essentially arrayed the census tracts into three categories. The green are greater than 80 years of life expectancy. The yellow are between 74 and 80 years. And the red is less than 74 years. And we found that we had these concentrated hotspots of premature death in Alameda County. And it wasn't randomly distributed. And we needed to explain those concentrated deaths, areas of premature death. And in Alameda County, you have people living in neighborhoods where the average age of death is around 65, 66 years. We worked with some friends up in Seattle, King County. They published a very similar study looking at their jurisdiction. We worked with some friends in Baltimore, Maryland, the city Department of Public Health in Baltimore. They did the same thing. They found, and I happen to have been born and went to medical school in Baltimore, so it was particularly interesting to me, but they found some dramatic disparities. You can't see this, but a life expectancy difference of 62.5 years down by the Inner Harbor and then 82.9 years up in the northern area. This is LA. They did something very similar and published it in the Los Angeles Times. This is Cuyahoga County, Cleveland. Anybody from Cleveland here? Anybody from Ohio here? Oh, okay, good. So there's a neighbor. Unfortunately for Cleveland, thus far, it has the greatest disparity that we've been able to document. We don't believe it has the greatest disparity out there, but it's the only one that we can document that has this grand a disparity. But there's a neighborhood in East Cleveland called Huff with a life expectancy of 64 years. And then just down the street, there's a neighborhood called Lyndhurst with a life expectancy of almost 89 years. So trying to justify this difference based on access to health care and behaviors is, if you ask me, lacking in critical thinking. It's ignoring the context of these life expectancy differences. This is something that Robert Wood Johnson did, where they calculated essentially your life expectancy based on where you got off on the transit system. So literally where you get off determines how long you're going to live. So the other thing you can do, and this is the only math, I promise, for those of you who thought you'd never have to see math again. This is the boot again, Alameda County, and the upper left is the census tract map by poverty, which is just poverty from the census, and then the lower right is life expectancy, and you can correlate those two. So for every neighborhood or census tract, you have a life expectancy and you have a poverty rate. So you can put that on what's called a bivariate correlation. One axis is life expectancy going up the top, and then the other one is poverty going across the bottom. And you see as you move from left to right, from essentially wealthier neighborhoods to poorer neighborhoods, life gets shorter. And in an ideal world, this should be a flat line. It is not a flat line because we don't live in an ideal world. And our job is to try to flatten that line and explain the slope of this line. And that's what our practice is trying to get at. Now, you can see that you have people in Alameda County live in neighborhoods with life expectancies in the mid-80s, others that have life expectancies in the mid-60s. If you look at the world life expectancy map, you're talking about the socio-ecological equivalent of Japan and Germany, as well as Pakistan and Bhutan in the same county. And so what we're trying to do is figure out, A, why that is, and B, what it is that we can do about the determinants that drive this ridiculous disparity in life expectancy. So we ran the same analysis for the San Francisco Bay Area, and this is what it looks like. And we calculated that every additional $12,500 in household income buys you a year of life in the San Francisco Bay Area, and encourage people to use that number when they're negotiating their raises, and et cetera. There's some epidemiologists in the room, I won't ask you to raise your hands because you're having a little bit of discomfort now saying, well, that's an association, doesn't prove cause and effect. So I always include this slide, which is a longitudinal cohort study in Alameda County. It's still ongoing, 7,000 Alameda County residents from 1965 forward. Amongst the published results are those with a household income with a standard deviation above the mean are 25% less likely to die prematurely. If you have a household standard deviation, one standard deviation below the mean, you're 35% more likely to die prematurely. So this is the best evidence you could possibly ask for to prove this impact. So our argument is essentially disparities are the tip of the iceberg, and we have to get underneath the waterline to understand what's actually happening in these communities and think about what it is we can do and how we do it to undo these things. So that brings us to building healthy communities. Don't try to read this. We made essentially a bet, and it's a bet that's still ongoing. We're betting that we can take $1 billion over the next 10 years in 14 low-income communities throughout the state of California and improve health outcomes more effectively by investing in strategies to mitigate the social determinants of health rather than in spending that $1 billion on health care. That's our bet. It's between 2010 and 2020. And what I'm going to do now is talk to you about sort of our strategy, how we think we ought to be doing this, what are the comprehensive elements of that work, and that ultimately rolls up to building healthy communities and what you're going to hear from this panel today. So we gave our communities 10 outcomes that were based on some work that we did with a group called PolicyLink, which looked at the socio-ecological environment in our communities and divided them into four basic domains: the physical environment, the social environment, the services environment, and the economic environment. And these 10 outcomes are basically just re-adaptations of those four elements of the environment in our communities. And we asked our communities to prioritize amongst these outcomes and select 3 to 5 that they were willing to work on for a period of years. We went through an extensive planning process, which ultimately lasted over a year in these 14 communities, had multiple stakeholder involvement, a heavy emphasis on direct resident engagement, and you're going to hear from America Bracho about some of those processes. And our communities selected what they wanted to work on. I show you this because I want to reemphasize that communities understand the social determinants of health much better than we do in public health. It's kind of amazing. So they said the number one thing they wanted to work on was neighborhood safety. Number two were jobs. Number three was land use and the built environment. And then, of course, came the Affordable Care Act, which they expressed some interest in, but we recognized it was something we could not leave on the table. Tens of billions of dollars for California residents over the next several years, a huge opportunity to leverage federal resources. So we brought that in to complement the social determinants work that we're doing. We've translated all that boring public health speak into what we think are sort of more compelling campaign languages. And you're going to hear from Daniel Zingali about our Changing the Narrative efforts. We have an overall campaign called Health Happens Here, and three strategic sub-campaigns: Health Happens in Neighborhoods, Health Happens in Schools, and Health Happens in Prevention. You're going to hear about that in a second. Within each of those campaigns, in each of our places, we have these content maps, and these are the actual policy targets and strategies and goals that our communities have decided that they want to prioritize and work on. And they differ across the 14 sites, but they all array themselves into these three strategic campaigns. The basic structure of the work is that there are four systems in each of our places that we feel we need to target. We need to target the health systems. We need to target the human service systems, which are disproportionately the criminal justice system. We need to target the school system and then the land use, the physical, social, and economic environments, those systems that construct the physical and some of the social space in our communities. And we feel that, and I like to say it this way, we need to get the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker to come together and work together across silos and find common purpose. And so we fund an ongoing table for this collaborative work where we're hoping to find innovative policy approaches, new ideas, leverage unusual sources of capital to actually address these core systems and the policy targets within those systems. And that's called the hub. So a fundamental premise of our work is that we are pursuing transformative change. We're not looking for what is sometimes referred to as transactional change, which is essentially making the existing systems just operate more efficiently. We're trying to actually disrupt those systems. We want new systems, new approaches that are targeted at the fundamental goals that those systems ought to be targeted at, rather than just the deliverables that they get paid for in their grants or their programs. And that requires, and I know this personally, having run a public health department, you have to bring people together and forge relationships across silos. And you have to keep them in relationship over time, not just around the grant of the week, but over time, so that they can actually form human relationships and work towards these deeper goals. So our key strategies in these places, and this is sort of like the take-home message, and this is what we're trying to illustrate on the panel, is that we think that there are five key drivers of change in this work, and then you have to do them all. One is you have to build resident social, political, and economic power. And America Bracho is going to talk about some of that work in Santa Ana and elsewhere. And we believe that you have to actually build that power in a critical mass of the residents living in that community to change the status quo, to hold systems accountable for better outcomes and better priorities. And so that work is essential to what we're trying to do, but we think that that's not enough. We think that there is no revolution in the history of mankind that has been led by old people, and so we have to engage youth and youth leadership, and David Valdez, who's an expert in this, is going to talk to you about that today. We want to enhance cross-sectoral collaboration, as I said, and that's what our hub is about. That's not all that new, but the institutions and the infrastructure for fostering that cross-sectoral collaboration is something that you have to maintain and you have to support, and that's what our hubs are about. We want to leverage innovative partnerships. We're not going to talk about that today, but we have, for instance, created a fund to build grocery stores in low-income communities in California. We've raised almost $300 million to do that, with an initial our leveraged amount of money is $30 million, which we put into that fund. So we're about 8.5 to 1, 9 to 1 right now. We can imagine getting to $300 million. And we think that that is a unique thing. I think it's a unique thing, quite frankly. I had no idea that you could get, you know, banks to build grocery stores in low-income communities. And I've started to realize that capital is largely agnostic. As long as you can promise some sort of return, they're like, okay, I'm in. And that was news to me, but we're not talking about that today. And finally, we're talking about crafting a new narrative in this work. And you see the people in the orange shirts running around. Hopefully you've seen on the side of the Metreon our enormous billboards, life expectancy and the differential life expectancies. That kind of blew me away, actually, quite frankly. But the goal here is to really create a new narrative, have new messengers and a different message about what health is and what actually builds health in communities. And so Daniel Zingali is going to talk to you about that. So let me just quickly take you through, and there are some people in the room that are familiar with this acronym, BARHI. This is the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, and it was, at the time that I was with, it was nine Bay Area health departments working together out of frustration, largely because the tools that we were offered in public health practice were not up to the challenge of the problems that we were seeing in communities. And we realized we needed to have new tools and develop a new practice. And so BARHI worked together to try to construct this practice. And much of this work is actually a product of that and other efforts. Well, one of the things that BARHI created is this thing we call the BARHI framework. We don't call it a model, we call it a framework, because if you call it a model, then people start arguing about which way the arrow should be pointing. So it's a framework. And the downstream side of the framework, the right-hand side, is basically the medical model, which basically says that risk factors and risk behaviors produce premature disease, which produces premature death. And the levers that you have to deal with are basically health education, genetics to some extent, and access to health care. And that's where we spend about 96% of our $2.6 trillion in health that we spend in the United States. An enormous amount of money, and if you practice medicine, as I do, you always feel like it's not enough. And our recognition at BARHI was that we had to get upstream and design a practice that addressed the drivers of this downstream cascade of premature disease. And so we argued that there was a set of beliefs, a narrative, in essence, that historically in this country was really built around racism, around gender bias, around discrimination against people who were disabled, against immigrants, against people of different sexual orientations, that actually shaped a set of institutional practices and policies that differentially favored different populations. Thus, you had things like segregation and redlining and a whole host of official policies that were designed to limit the opportunity of certain populations. And that produced social inequities, or the East Baltimores and the East Oaklands and the Comptons and the south sides of Chicago, that concentrate premature death and disparities. And then we approach this problem with a medical solution. And you very quickly, if you have any critical thinking skills, recognize that that's an insufficient set of tools for the problems that we're confronting. So this is what BARHI was trying to do, was to figure out what are the upstream tools that we need to use to develop this practice. So downstream is the world of health disparities. Upstream is the world of health inequities. You can take the word health out of there and just talk about inequities driving disparities. You can take out the fancy words and just talk about conditions producing consequences. The healthcare system is consequence management. What we're trying to talk about is changing the conditions, and that's what the nature of building healthy communities is. You can take the downstream product out and change it from health to education and talk about school absence producing grade failure, producing dropout. The upstream conditions remain exactly the same. So our argument is we have to spend less time thinking about the downstream, although it's necessary. Necessary but not sufficient. And develop a practice upstream. So we've simplified this practice to the notion of narrative, a new narrative creating healthier policies, more equitable policies that produces changes in people's living conditions, how people live. And this doesn't necessarily only relate to geography. It can relate to working conditions. It can relate to the way various populations are stigmatized based on their status. We think there's a role for family and culture. We're not going to talk about that again today, but it's a fascinating subject. And if you know anything about the immigrant health paradox, you recognize that there are aspects of being an immigrant in this country that are health protective, and we need to encourage that. We need to learn from that. We need to design interventions that actually take the lessons of the immigrant experience in this country. As immigrants acculturate, they get less healthy. America is not good for your health. And finally, there's a power arc here, and it's about building power in place to be able to have that power concentrate its efforts on the policy-making systems that create the conditions in those places. So this is a little bit of a reflex arc. It's not indiscriminate power. It's power to focus in place. It's to sharpen the head of the spear to be able to essentially make the change in place that's relevant to people's lives. Okay, very simply, the old model is behavior drives disease, drives premature death. Our model is that there are a set of biased beliefs or narrative historically, some of which continues into the present day, that create policies and practices, largely on the part of institutions, that create neglected communities. And we have a set of strategies downstream for preventing death. We call them emergency rooms. We spend a lot of money there to try to manage disease. We have clinics. And to try to change behaviors, we have health education, some of which is actually quite creative and effective, including a lot of social norms change work that has grown from that area. I don't want to dismiss it. But we need a new practice that looks at neglected communities. We call it essentially building power and leadership. And you're going to hear from two of the best in the country on that in a minute when I stop talking. We think that that's not enough. You also have to work on policies and leveraging partnerships. And you have to create the conditions for ongoing cross-sectoral collaboration that's relevant to the priorities of people living in place. We think that that's not enough. We think we have to create a new narrative. And all of that has to happen together. So this is essentially the boiled-down Barhai model. The upstream side and those green arrows is where we get the so-called drivers of change. And so you're going to hear about three of those five drivers today. We can talk about any of them in the question and answer, but I just wanted to make sure you understand sort of the rationale for designing this initiative in this way. Okay, so the drivers of change are power, what we call collaborative efficacy. We're trying to change that word because it's too public health wonky. Youth leadership, leveraging partnerships, and changing the narrative. We think that that's the special recipe for building healthy communities. Very simply, it's about power, it's about policy, and it's about narrative. And those three things, we think, are not currently regularly practiced in public health practice today. And we think that the 21st century public health practice is going to be focused on a new narrative, it's going to be focused on building power, and it's going to be focused on leveraging partnerships and fostering very highly effective and efficient collaboration across sectors. Okay, so our first speaker is Dr. America Braccio. I'm going to read a little bit of her bio here so that we can keep ourselves going. And she's my good friend, and I always feel good when I'm with her. She is the executive director of Latino Health Access, a center for promotion and disease located in Santa Ana, California. The center was created under leadership and to assist with the multiple health needs of Latinos in Orange County. Latino Health Access facilitates mechanisms of empowerment for the Latino community and uses participatory approaches to community health education. The program trains community health workers as leaders of wellness and change. She's also worked as a physician in her native Venezuela for many years. She came to the U.S. to obtain a master's degree in public health at the University of Michigan, and her public health specialty is health education and health behavior. But you may know her in addition to Health Access. Look, that's you. You may know her from Bill Moyers. She's been interviewed as an expert on community organizing. You may know her from Weight of the Nation. She was a central character in talking about community participation and engagement in that HBO documentary. You may know her just from hearing her speak, and you will never forget her after you hear her speak. Never. And she's going to talk about power and participation. But let me actually introduce everybody so that I don't have to go through all this. Our next speaker is going to be David Valdez. And David is currently the director of the Youth Institute of the Weingart East LA YMCA. His role there is to uphold a digital media program for high school youth and serves as co-chair of the Youth Engagement Committee for Building Healthy Communities in Boyle Heights. He has a BA from Yale University and an MFA from the American Conservatory Theater right here in San Francisco, so he's a homeboy. David is one of the most interesting people you'll ever meet. He is a very compelling speaker and youth organizer. He can hold the rapt attention of young people, which is something I cannot do. So I will tell you right now, I'm already in awe of him because he can actually keep them focused on this work. That is a real skill. I'll tell you, if you ever... The most nervousness I've ever had in my life is having to speak to an auditorium of adolescents. Because they literally, if they don't, after 10 seconds, if they don't like what you're saying, they are literally staring up in the sky saying... So David is also a compelling communicator and has been, you know, essential to our work throughout building healthy communities, and you're going to see why today. He's going to talk about youth leadership and engagement. And then finally, my friend Daniel Zingali. Uh-oh, somebody got rid of my thing here. There it is. Daniel's done everything, quite frankly. And you know, I asked him for his bio, and he said, no, I don't want to do it. So he just gave me a couple of bullet points, but I'm going to throw a few other things in there. Formerly, he was a CEO of a national AIDS action organization in the 1990s that refocused efforts on prevention in communities of color. He was a cabinet secretary to Governor Gray Davis and has led the state's anti-tobacco, participated in leading the state's anti-tobacco efforts, chief of staff to Maria Shriver and senior advisor to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and was architect of the California bipartisan health reform that was a model for Obamacare. But let me tell you a little bit more about Daniel. First of all, he's one of these people that is behind change. Whenever you see progressive change in California, you know Daniel Zingali's fingerprints are on it somehow. Besides being an AIDS activist and a leader, he's a master in communications and understands this whole notion of essentially changing the narrative. And so much of what you see around you throughout this conference in terms of trying to really change the conversation about health is the product of Daniel's vision and brilliance. So he's going to talk about changing the narrative. And without any further ado, I should say I have no commercial conflicts of any sort, and others will similarly declare. Okay.
So we need to speak from there?
You need to speak from the microphone.
Good morning. So what I want to do in 20 minutes, because I respect you so much, and because I want to use this for you and for me, I'm going to give permission to myself to think out loud. And I hope I have given some thought to my thinking out loud. Otherwise, I'm going to end up correcting myself in public. But I really have a lot of respect for what we do. A lot of respect for our contributions to making the world a healthier place. But when Tony talks about a narrative, I think that when he puts this narrative and then power and policies and practices, I think that policies actually influence the narrative and the power, and the narrative influences the power. So it's almost like each of those elements influence each other. And as he was thinking, and I have my notes, but I'm so comfortable with my colleagues here and the people that are doing similar things around the nation, that I'm going to follow this within this conversation that Tony has invited us to join. When he talks about the narrative, I ask myself, the narrative, whose narrative? Who is talking? Who is the system? Who is making policies? Who is writing grants? Who is designing interventions? Who is the CDC? Who is the Department of Public Health? I mean, many of those are sitting here. We are that. We also are the mother of Danny and the sister of Carmen. We also are that. We are both. And it's very interesting to me that we forgot about it. For those that forgot about it. That either we are the public health director or the sister of Carmen. And that's very weird. It is very weird that we have gone through institutions that have made us believe that we, in order to be effective as professionals, we have to abandon who we are. And I think that at the essence of these disparities and the issue of equality is that the people that are trying to move the solution, the good people and the bad people, bought in the same narrative. And the same narrative is a narrative of exclusion, either because I am the one with the public health degree or because I really don't care about undocumented people. Whether it's that reason or the other reason, the result is the same. It's exclusion of the people that do not have a master or are undocumented or poor or unemployed or sick or people that do not have health insurance. And the institutions have done an incredible job in making us believe that we are different. And I think that at the essence, at the real essence of this conversation is that if we don't start asking ourselves in what way we actually are the community and we are similar, we are not going to recognize in Maria and Pedro and Luisa and the people that sell tamales our own self. And unless we recognize in the people of the community our own self, they will not have a seat at the table. And unless they have a seat at the table, the only agenda we are going to move is our agenda. And our time is going to be invested, like my time is invested so many times, in writing grants and dealing with the county and dealing with the many opportunities or problems that we have, you know, as a director of an organization. And many times I forget that there are people that are actually going blind. There are people that actually, they don't care about the next program on obesity. They are still dying of HIV. Hey, who cares about obesity? Is that a new thing now? I'm going to die of this before I die of that. And actually, someone else can raise their hand and say, "Yo, before all of that, I'm going to get killed in my neighborhood." While you write your grant. And here I am thinking that I'm one of them. Oh yeah, right. And you know why I'm not? I am one of them. But you know why I'm not? I'm not because I don't live in that neighborhood. I'm not because I have not one degree, but maybe another degree and some certificates, and people address me as Señora, Doña, Mrs. or Doctor or whatever. Although sometimes in Anaheim they also call me undocumented and they don't know if I am or I'm not. But that's the other people, that they don't know my degrees really. So, and if I tell them the degrees, they could care less because I'm a Latina and that doesn't matter anymore. In many ways, it's great that that happened to me, because then they remind me that I am also part of this community. And every time a kid gets killed, it really reminds me that I also have kids. And at the end of the day, I decided that I wanted to work in changing my own narrative. The narrative that was in my head for so many years, saying the professional and the personal are different. And I decided that that was not true many years ago. And the woman that is working in Latino Health Access is America Bracho, is a Latina. And is a woman that is ready to fight for women and for these Latinos, whether they are documented or undocumented. And what is not right is not right. And it's not right, and I don't care. What is not right is not right. And in order to remind me that I was working in changing the narrative, we decided to hire the community and create two departments of accountability. The accountability for the money and the accountability for this changing narrative. And we brought 42 promotores, including compañeras that have been victims of domestic violence and now are running the program. And people with diabetes that came through the programs and now are teaching the classes. And if I decide to change diabetes for asthma, they are going to say, "What are you doing? Why are we going to do that? And now you're not going to have a depression support group because you don't have money from United Way? Are you crazy, woman?" You know, so we have 42 promotoras and a mechanism for them to inform the strategy. So I don't want to forget. Am I at risk of forgetting? Oh, yes, I went to the university too many years. So I am at risk. And I can tell you what I talk to them. We go on retreats, we go to the mountains, we try to have these conversations often enough, so our heart keeps the energy to keep going. But I tell them that there was a time in which institutions didn't exist. There was a time in which we were eating outside. We didn't even have like houses. We have caves. And then one day we decided to create, one of the caves was called school. And then we sent our kids to learn. And then there was a very wise woman that was a healer. Later on, they were called witches. And that's why doctors became males, because they killed the witches. But at the beginning, there were a lot of women that were healing, And then somehow it got organized and we created hospitals and so forth. And we created institutions. And the problem with that is that then institutions thought that they could do it without us. And we thought it was okay for them to do it without us. They learned how not to work with us, how to exclude us, and we learned how to be excluded and not participate. And right now, when Tony makes that proposal, we're in deep trouble. Because we already learned how not to participate. And if we learn how not to participate in the convenience of our desk and our technical training, believe me, some other people learn how not to participate in the reality of their own survival. But if you don't, if you have the right not to vote because you are too busy, they have the right not to vote because they have to work three jobs. But we even in our narrative think that we have, you know, some privilege of not participating because we are smart, busy people. But those people deserve to live like that because they are not participating. And those people, my friend, is you and I. And until we recognize not only that people need to participate and need to be at the table so we don't forget their own reality. They will not let you forget, but they need to be at the table. And the problem with that, again, in the narrative and the essence of our practice, and this is not a political practice, this is a human practice, is that when we think participation, there is this dominant discourse that comes to our head and says, oh, but who needs to participate? How people that participate look? And then it goes into that area that is very, very dangerous when you don't know about it. Is that area that tells you that beautiful people look like this, successful people look like this, intelligent people look like this, powerful people look like this. So guess what? I'm working with people that sell tamales. I'm working with people that have been victims of domestic violence. And when they go into my registry, it doesn't look like that. So la tamalera, the little petite, overweight lady with long black hair, doesn't look like a leader. And then it has to go through my filter and say, does she? But when you get to know Sonia La Tamalera, and not only you know that Sonia is a survivor of many things, is raising four kids, is selling tamales and paying the school at UCI for her son, always have the best ideas on how to do ballet folclorico, is the one that brings the snacks for our children promotore. And after training and training, she became the representative of her community in one of the boards. Then you start saying, oh my God, what happened in my brain? How I couldn't see her. Then they say, you are welcome in our communities, all you masters in public health. We will retrain you and show you the ways of the community, which actually are your ways, but you forgot. And there is a group in theater, it's called Cultural Clash, and they say, they have a play in which, the play is called Latinos Anonymous. Latinos Anonymous, and you go there and you say, my name is Pedro, and I'm Latino, and then people go like, hey. It's like a 12-step group for people that are ashamed that they are Latinos. So as part of the therapeutic intervention that they do, they burn a tortilla. And with the smoke, they go like this and they go, remember, remember. So what we do in the community is to get to know the people, build a relationship, go deeper, get the people, when you meet them, that's for us, for Latino Hotasas, that's level one leadership. The person that came because they need a class, because they have a problem, that's level one. When that person volunteers, that's level two leadership. And then we start training. On level three, they are volunteer on their own, and they are being more trained. On level four, they are representing their community. Leadership is recognized when people ask for services. And we treat people as leaders. So we are creating our own indicators of participation, et cetera, et cetera. But the best remedy to cure this lack of awareness that sometimes we have is to bring the community inside and let them teach you. Being a table, talking about systems like Tony is talking today, talking about those squares, and talking about systems and outcomes and logic models. And have Sarai saying, what is what we are going to do with the kid that was killed this morning? And then your brain can say, uh-oh, here they are. They really don't get the root causes of this politics. Or you can say, I'm being irrelevant. I'm being so irrelevant. And then you can say, is there a way we can be relevant to the today, but still invest in the long term? And how do I work with them, in that path? And I read a beautiful book from a great writer saying that we work with questions and agreements. And we have to ask each other questions to agree if we go that way or this way. And then we reach an agreement that allows us to advance. And I can tell you that is what we are working in Santa Ana. Asking a lot of questions. We were working on that when the endowment, who has been a partner for years, came with this very assertive and clear and brave proposal. Let's invest in doing more of that. And then they gave organizations the possibility of doing that, but also of relearning their own proposal to the community and bringing more of those residents and put them at the table. And believe me, like they say, it could be messy. And it's particularly messy when you think that nobody should challenge you. Because we come from schools where we have entitlements. Doctors that, you know, the nurse cannot talk to you that way. And now the community is saying, so who are you? And that is a very interesting thing that will force, again, to rethink our narrative. So these residents in Santa Ana are at the table. They are having trouble with too much long-term and not today. We are having problems with our own credibility because we are a lot in today and long-term. We are having problems with the use of the words, creating a vocabulary that we can share. Between yo quiero que me cuiden, I want the police to take care of my community, but I hate them because they hate us. But now you told me we need to work with them in some sort of system? Y bueno, pues, by the moment you are talking the second time about that, I mean, it's 3 weeks into the process, 4 weeks into the process, and things are not going to move as fast as they could if you are the only one making the decision. But if we are the only ones making the decision, we are not building anything. And we're going to be at the end with a result that will disappear the day we retire. And that is not worth it. It's not fair. And it's not right. And it's particularly wrong when you understand that this agenda is as personal as it is professional. This is my agenda as a woman and as a mom. And in that moment, when I rethink, then all of a sudden, I understand that we need to put the time. And Tony needs to make sure that I understand. And I need to make sure that he understands. And when he's not understanding, I invite him to eat tamales with Doña Sonia. And then I say to Doña Sonia, talk to him. And then we are in the same page. And you know the luxury of working with a foundation that actually gets it? The luxury of having a foundation and not being afraid of the funder, but being a partner of the funder? And for many years now, Latino Health Access have said that we are not targeting this community. We are partnering with this community. We partner with everybody there, the same way this foundation is partnering with us, and the same way we hope that you partner with your own community. Thank you so much.
Well, that's just not fair. Everything she said. Except we talked to you. So, good morning. My name, once again, is David Valdez. And my piece today is to talk about the role of youth development in building healthy communities. And actually, as I was going through my notes and listening to America speak, it actually is very similar. When we talk about community, it doesn't matter if you're residents or adults, it's all one community. But you have to have certain structures in the way that you speak to parents and that are very different from the way that you speak to youth. And so, you know, with all due respect, I agree with America. All those fancy PowerPoint presentations don't work with our youth. And in fact, I'm going to try to infuse this presentation with as much youth language as possible. So if I throw a curse word or not, you're welcome. So, this youth development is a huge component of building healthy communities. And when I started to think about it, it's actually very, very simple, but it takes a lot of effort. And I hope at the end of the presentation that you'll agree with me. It's very simple. And mostly when you talk to teenagers and they're thinking about public health, if they're thinking about it at all, health to them is a visit to a doctor for an annual checkup or perhaps, you know, to fix a broken bone. If we're lucky, health to a teenager is also maybe, you know, using a condom or practicing safe sex. That's what health is. Of course, in our work for good health, it includes a much bigger equation. It's not just physical health, but it also involves emotional health, mental health, spiritual health, and the health of your environment. All very important components that, as Dr. Iden spoke earlier, determines that pretty much where you live is how long that you're going to live. We can figure that out. There's an actual equation for that. So the health of our environment is very different, and here's where the effort comes in. We have to educate about health being more than just a doctor's visit. And we have to work with our youth to make sure that they understand that that is a much bigger component. And so in developing youth leadership, I begin with the very basics. I begin with the understanding of that equation, that health and good health is an equation in the sum of all those parts. Physical health, emotional health, mental health, spiritual health, and the health of your environment or your community. And these are all pieces that we got to work on to make yourself feel important. So when I work with them, I try to practice what I preach. Because there's no point in trying to build a healthy community if I'm not working on trying to build a healthier me. So first and foremost, it's very simple, but it takes a lot of effort. I try to run a couple miles a week, a couple times a week. I try to eat healthy snacks. If we provide snacks for them, and we do that a lot, they try to be healthy snacks and not anything that is going to affect them in a negative way. I don't discourage them drinking soda, but I do encourage them making better choices. And so if there's ever an opportunity where we try to encourage healthy snacks, we provide those snacks for them. So you think about all of these parts, and in the end, when you're speaking to youth, in order to for them effectively to capture to this notion of what being a healthy person is, the work has got to be personal. And you heard America speak about that. The same is for me. When I speak with youth, the work has got to be personal. If it's not personal, what's the point? Because we're trying to affect lives here. We're not trying to get TV ratings or anything like that. We're trying to affect lives and actually improve the health of communities. So if you'll give me a second, I try to be honest with my youth, and so I like to share with you my own personal story because I feel like we have to be responsive to what it is that they listen to. So you already heard this, but my name is David. I am the youngest of seven children. Five of my brothers and sisters were born in Mexico, and the other two were born right here in the United States. And I like to joke around that being the child of an immigrant parent, that it's pretty simple. Five in Mexico, two in America. It's pretty simple to figure out which kids were born where just from the names that my parents gave us. Because it goes Ermelinda, Maria Concepcion, Miguel Angel, Guillermo, Jaime Humberto, Elizabeth, and David. It's that simple. This is David. Five of my brothers born in Mexico. Five of my brothers and sisters born in Mexico. Two of us right here made in the USA. And I started uncovering the path of my own story not too long ago because I started writing about this. And I realized in doing so that my family immigrated to this country in the year 1976. And it's an important fact. Specifically, they immigrated to this country on July 4th. For any historians out there, that is the bicentennial of America. So this is how I know that I came from smart genes, because while America was celebrating their 200th birthday, with their barbecues and fireworks, my mom was sneaking my brothers and sisters across the border. Of course, I am of Latino descent, and I like to tell everybody that, you know, I am Mexican on my mother's side and alcoholic on my dad's side. And I joke about that, but it's somewhat of a reality. I'm not an alcoholic in reality, but, you know, that was the dichotomy of the household that I grew up in. So much so that at the age of 5, my father ended up having to leave our family, and we had to fight for survival. I grew up lower class, and my family ended up in a town called East L.A. And East L.A. is known for, you know, much like the Mission District here, primarily a Latino community. It's a neighborhood where my mom is very, very comfortable and has never had the need to really learn English because it in this community, Spanish is a prevalent language. So you can get around still operating as a monolingual speaker there. So it was very important for our family to end up there, in addition to knowing, you know, the ins and outs of a community where you know, language was important, but also the culture was celebrated from a place that we came from. So I worked really hard getting good grades. I worked really, really hard. And that's because at the end of 7 kids, my older brothers and sisters who were smart themselves didn't have the opportunities that I had growing up. So they're just as smart, if not smarter, than I am. And when they graduated high school, they wanted to go to college, but they couldn't because my family couldn't afford them to. In fact, because my father had left, a lot of my brothers and sisters had to work in order for our family to survive. And that was the reality. So I knew that as I was coming up through grade school, that I was working hard to get good grades, not just for myself, but because I owed it to all of them as well. And there's a story that I like to share that my sister, my second older sister, Maria, who took over the financial responsibility of our family, she would tell my youngest sister and I, she said, if you guys ever need anything for school, just let me know. And it didn't dawn on me back then what kind of consequences that might have had on us, but I remember being in junior high and my sister said, you know, we have to start doing a lot of reports. We need a computer. Somehow, miraculously, the next week, there was a computer in our household. I don't know if it was finance or I don't know what kind of sacrifices my sister had to make, but I realized now as an adult, we couldn't afford that computer, but we had it there because my sister knew how important that was. So when I got through high school, I worked really hard and was heavily involved in community, and when it came time to apply for college, I actually got accepted to Yale University, so you heard that at the top. That's true. And when I traveled 3,000 miles to go to this Ivy League campus, let me tell you, there was a lot of culture shock. A lot. Tremendous amount. Even though I was excited for the adventure, when I got there, 6 of my freshman year roommates, 6 males and myself, again, the end of 7, were Jewish. All of them Jewish. Since this is a public health conference, I can share with you this fact. I don't want to tell you how I know this, but out of the 7, I'm pretty sure I was the only one with an uncircumcised penis. We'll figure out how this fits in later on. So I quickly learned, being there at Yale University, in the first weeks, in the first days, in the first moments of being there, how the other half lives. It was very, very clear to me. And it became even more clear when the Yale tuition bill came around. And all the parents were there for opening weekend, except for mine, because I didn't have anybody to travel with me. And, you know, I remember my direct roommate, Eric Weiss, his mom was saying, Eric, I got to pay your tuition. How much is that? And he said, Mom, it's $35,000. And she took out a checkbook and she took out a pen and she wrote a check out to $35,000 to Yale University. And it was a regular size check, not one of those sweepstakes checks that you get from the publisher's clearinghouse. And I looked at that, and I was like, people can really do that? Wow. You know, and Yale came knocking, and they said, you know, tuition, $35,000 a year. And I raised my hand, and I was like, excuse me, I can't afford that. And they were gracious enough to say, don't worry about it. We got you covered. And so I pretty much got a full ride during the time that I was there. And 4 years later, I graduated as part of the 300th class. And when I graduated, I actually was awarded and honored with the Lewis Sutler Prize for Creative and Performing Arts. So I was the one class member in this tercentennial class for Yale University that got to walk the stage as the most exceptional in creative and performing arts, something that I'm very proud of. But I don't like to brag about it too much. And let me tell you why. Because for 4 years, I was on the East Coast, hitting the books, trying to earn this Ivy League education. My mom was back in East LA telling all of her friends, "Oh, Jess, my son is going to jail. He's going to jail for 4 years." That was the impression that she was giving her friends. And the odd thing about it, her friends accepted it. Because that's the type of community that we work in. The reality is, yeah, our kid can go to college, but just as simply, our kid can be in jail. Our kid can be having troubles. So I took everything I learned and I started working in public health, I guess, through this Building Healthy Communities initiative. And the reason that I tell you my story is because I think that it's important to share our stories, especially with the youth. Today they are, for a want of needing guidance and mentorship, but for a huge lack in finding the individuals that can actually provide the kind of mentorship that they need. And in my particular case, Boyle Heights is adjacent to East LA, so I grew up pretty much in the community that I am now serving. And so for me to serve as the role model for something that they can be in the future is remarkable, and that's really why I love to do the work that I do. Just last week, I had one of my Youth Institute kids sit with me, and he just wanted to know what it was like to get into Yale, to be at Yale, to be in college. And so for 30 minutes, we talked. And we just talked, and I shared with him the pretties and the bads of going to an Ivy League education and the hardships of getting there, but also the significance of what it has provided for me in my lifetime. On the other end of things, you know, we face and work with youth that are very troubled. In fact, a couple years ago, I met a young man by the name of Frederick. And Frederick was going through some case management for some bad behavior that he was undergoing. And he was part of this violence intervention program that I was a participant in. These kids need to feel like they count. They need to feel like they're valid. And that's what I try to do in my work with them. And Frederick and I had a relationship for a couple of years in that I was trying to work with him. I recognized that even though Frederick was having troubled times, and that trouble was because there was trouble at home, he wasn't being as healthy as he could, he was making bad decisions and not essentially practicing good habits. He needed somebody to show him what good habits were. And so I was trying to do that. And I noticed in him a creativity that I tried to blossom. And I worked with him as much as possible. And a few months ago, he ran into some trouble, and we kind of separated in our contact. He had to go and take care of things on his own, and I had outreach to him as much as I could before it was time for me to step away. Well, 3 weeks ago, he called me, and he said, "Mr. David, I just wanted to call to let you know something. I got accepted back into my public school because he had been kicked out, and I'm going through a rehabilitation program, and I'm seeing some counselors. And about a month ago, I don't know if you know this, but I tried to commit suicide. But the reason I'm calling to talk to you is because you always made me count. And I want you to know that I might need your help in the future, but I want you to know that I'm doing better, and I appreciate that you made me feel special." And that's the kind of care and concern and kindness that I try to teach all of our youth. It's personal. It's very simple, but it takes a lot of effort. My Youth Institute program, it's a youth leadership program. We teach technology. We teach every summer, we take 25 kids and show them how to make films. And we take them through every step of the process, from storyboard development, camera technique, digital music, graphic design, and then we actually do the filming and the editing. And this filmmaking essence, this digital media, is something that, you know, it's a creative world for me, so I thrive in it. But But the real important thing to me is that it's not about the filmmaking, it's about what we're teaching them as we're practicing these habits. We're teaching them how to problem solve, because if we run into a problem that we don't have the answer to the question, we figure out how do we solve it. And that's what I want them to learn. So if we run into a situation where we don't have the answers, well, let's look it up. Let's get the technology and let's figure it out. Because that's what I want them to practice when they're in college or on a career path. Two of my students this summer, and these are the last two stories that I want to share with you. Two of my students this summer, one of them was speaking to a guest that we had, and the guest wanted to know her place in our program and what it felt to be a part of something like this. And Jada Laban, who's actually in middle school, she said, you know what I like about this place? Here I can be myself. At school, I'm friends with all the popular kids, and I have to pretend a lot of times to be somebody that I don't want to be. And when I come here to the Youth Institute, I can just be my silly self, and nobody is judging me for it. And that was remarkable. And I knew that we were onto something in creating the safe haven where kids felt valid. This other individual, Eric Flores, in the middle of our program, and it's a work development program. So if they're late, we actually give them a stipend for participating. And if they're late during the summer, then we dock them. Of course, there's good reasons for them, you know, not to be present sometimes. This kid one day didn't show up, and his father calls me in the morning, speaks Spanish to me, said, sorry, my son can't be there today. He got hit by a car yesterday. He's in the hospital. He's doing okay, but he's probably going to miss a couple of days. And I said, don't worry about it, Mr. Flores. Make sure that he gets well and taken care of. Let us know if there's anything that we can do. Next day, I show up at work. Eric is sitting in his seat that he occupied every single day. And I went up to him and I said, Eric, what are you doing here? You should be at home resting. And he goes, well, Mr. David, that's just the thing. They told me that I had to be at home and resting, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be here with the Youth Institute and with my classmates, and I wanted to be here doing what it is that we do. And that gives me proof that what we're doing, the kind of careness, kindness, and compassion that we practice in our Youth Institute and in all of our programs, and we start to break it down how all of this affects them and their health, that it's important for them to be active participants. If I do my job in the future, the individuals that started with us a couple of years ago when they were 14, 15, 16 years old, at the end of this 10-year initiative, and by the way, initiative is such a troubling word, I have at times problems just spelling it. There's a T and an I and then an ITA and T. So this 10-year initiative, when it's done, the individuals that started with us will be 24, 25, 26. They're going to be adults. And that's when the policies that affect their families and their community are really going to start to blossom and take effect. So if we can start those good habits with them right now, that'll carry them into when they're adults, then I think, Dr. Iden, that we will build those healthy communities. Thank you very much.